right, I guess I will get started. Just to kind of keep everybody on schedule here so we don't go over an hour. My name is Matthew Wasberger. I am the manager for the accreditation program at the U.S. Chamber of Commerce. Sounds like I know a lot of you already from the call, but if not, I'm kind of the point person for any general questions on accreditation and then kind of oversee the overall program itself. But, yeah, I just wanted to welcome everybody to the summer conference call. It's the second conference call we held this year. We're hoping to do three or four. I sent invitations out to about 50 chambers of commerce, most of those coming from the August 31st deadline. So you guys are about 1 month away from submitting your application. Others are from the December 31st deadline, so you've got about 6 months. And then there's some prospects on there, people that I've talked with for a couple of months and are just trying to feel their way through the process and felt that this call might give you a good idea of where to go. Kind of go over some of the guidelines for the call. If you do have a mute button, I think they recommended in the last call that you push that just while the speakers are talking. Of course, this call is pretty informal, so we definitely open it up to questions and answers. We don't go through the operator here, so just be respectful of others and speak up and ask questions. But yeah, I feel we have a good program today. We're going to go over crisis planning to start with. From there, we'll kind of move into the new application, and we've got a testimonial from our first five-star chamber that used the new application. But, yeah, so we kind of chose crisis planning as our first topic today because of a recent study I saw from the Ohio Chamber executives. They kind of looked at our application, and about 75% said that the facilities section of the application was one of their strongest. And then we broke it down further and found that 42% of those people said that they didn't even have a crisis plan, a written crisis plan in place. Coupling this with the recent natural disasters in Iowa, the fires in California, and the upcoming hurricane season, we kind of thought it was a good topic to look at. So I'm going to open it up to our first speaker to kind of give her take on crisis planning. Our first speaker is Inez Pierce. She's the chief executive of Pierce Global Partners and one of our main consultants with the U.S. Chamber's Business Civic Leadership Center. So I will open the floor to Inez.
Thanks, Matthew. I'll give you a little bit of background on the Business Civic Leadership Center and then go into how we connect with crisis planning and then go into some details on the crisis planning. So the Business Civic Leadership Center, or BCLC, is a 501c3 affiliate of the U.S. Chamber of Commerce. BCLC is a chamber resource and a voice for businesses and their social and philanthropic interests. Basically, BCLC's vision is for the positive role of business and society to be understood and advanced, and how we do that is through three programs: corporate community investment, global corporate citizenship, and disaster assistance and recovery. Sorry about that. My cell phone just went off. So basically, under the Disaster Assistance Recovery Program is the one I'm going to speak most about. And the focus there is on communication, collaboration, and coordination between three sectors: the public sector, private, and nonprofit. And depending on the community, and I'm sure you've all had experiences, some communities are very good about communicating between the three sectors, and others have a little bit more, a few more challenges, especially when disasters occur. So we really are looking to assist long-term economic recovery in communities. And there are two initiatives that come under the Disaster Assistance and Recovery Program, which I'll talk about now. The first is the National Disaster Help Desk for Businesses. And this was really developed in response to the 2007 San Diego wildfires. Really, it's a resource to help chambers and communities, and really we got a lot of help from the Office Depot Foundation to make it a reality. But the help desk is designed to enhance community economic recovery after a disaster And when basically it's peacetime or there aren't a lot of disasters happening, it's also an opportunity to go into the community and help with building contacts and relationships before something occurs. So before the flooding and the tornadoes that happened in Iowa this year, we were actually working in Seattle with the communities there. So we monitor what's happening across the United States, and we'll activate the help desk to assist business recovery with the idea that we're assisting and building upon existing systems and communications between chambers, businesses, nonprofits, local, state, federal government, and fill gaps where they are needed. Now, again, every community is different, so how things work and how well the communication is working will really vary from one community to the next. So it is very important for us to work with the local chambers, to work with the state government, with any responding agencies, and find out truly what's needed, because it has to be tailored to the specific needs of that community that's in crisis. So when we activate the help desk in a disaster area, it's to provide a resource. And I really want to reiterate that we are a resource for all chambers. So just to give you an idea of the number to make it easy, it's 888-MY-BIZ-HELP, so my B-I-Z help, or 888-692-4943. So the idea is that during a disaster that people can call that number and they can ask questions. If they're not sure where to go, we can provide assistance on where to direct them. But also something else that we bring to a community is that we're helping to coordinate any of our national corporate donors in the area. So if corporate donors want to provide assistance or donations, they're not really sure where to go, because we're working in the community, we can help direct them to the right locations. One of the main things to remember, and I definitely would like everyone to remember this, is that when disaster strikes, you're not alone. And the help desk is really to support any chamber that's dealing with these devastating situations. And I'll give you a couple examples. In San Diego and Iowa, we put chamber leaders together with those that had experienced disasters in the past. So, for instance, we had chamber leaders from Manhattan, Louisiana, Florida, and a few others, where they had been through the experience and they could share ideas on how to guide these chambers that were facing a new danger and how to make decisions under extenuating circumstances, to say the least. So part of that is by helping to share information, we're actually helping communities that really aren't sure where to go, because many of them maybe haven't experienced this event at all. One of the other things in the help desk is that we work with the U.S. Small Business Administration. As they're going out and reaching out to chambers and businesses, we're also working very closely with them to help find out what's needed and also how we might be able to assist. The second thing I wanted to mention under the Disaster Assistance and Recovery Program really ties into the crisis planning. And that is, we have a working group which is made of large businesses that are focusing on some of these broader disaster questions and looking at how to come up with tangible solutions or how to focus different things that can help chambers. One thing that really kind of helps look at the plan that you're talking about creating or that you've already created is when you look at a community, you have supply and demand. And obviously an organization or a business that creates whether it's products or services, when a disaster strikes, they have difficulty potentially either providing the service or the product, or the community is in such shock from the disaster, they're not there to actually take or purchase the product, and so the business suffers. So there's a very direct link between a business and the community. If the community is not able to help the business by purchasing products or its services, everybody in the community suffers. So the crisis plan really plays a critical role in making sure that you're looking at your own interests and things that you need to prioritize to make sure you're able to support your members, your employees, and so forth, but also how to connect with the community at large and how to make sure that you can facilitate in different ways with your role the community recovery aspect. So with that, I want to jump into the crisis plan. So just so you know, it's also potentially known as a recovery plan, a response plan, or a business continuity plan. And as you're doing research or as you're talking to other chambers or other organizations about this, it's just important to know that basically they're all talking about the same thing with maybe a few types of differences. Basically what the U.S. Chamber has put together with this application is first conforming to all federal, state, and local building, fire, health, and safety regulations. And that's very important because in every community, there's not a one standard, for instance, with fire codes. So it's important to use that as your foundation for your plans. And from there, you're able to pick the pieces that are going to fit, and I'll talk about some of those in just a moment. So the application gives you a good starting place with the basics. And you want to be able to go through and select as many yeses as possible, but also look at, as far as what's a priority for your chamber, where you may want to take a few extra steps and take your preparedness planning to the next level. So, for instance, when we talk about the chamber role, that might be an area where you would do something beyond what's in the basic part of your plan. So at the very minimum, like I said, you start with those the standards with federal, state, and local. And then also look at what to do in a fire evacuation, which is the most likely type of disaster for all organizations. With that, look at other events that are most likely for you. So that might be hurricane, tornado, earthquake, flooding, wildfire, winter storms, whatever it might be, and include those types of disasters in your plan. So with that plan, it's got to include procedures of what people are going to do or what the chamber's role is going to be for each one of those events. And then you have to identify training for your employees on how to properly deal with those disaster events. As you can imagine, writing a plan, training employees, these are all things that are done before a disaster strikes. Now, obviously from our experience, and I'm sure from yours as well, we see that the tragedy of disaster and the important role of chambers during that time when they're responding to the disaster. But pre-disaster is really a good opportunity to discuss how to reduce your exposure, how to keep yourself out of harm's way, how to protect your employees, and so forth. So while everyone's going to respond after an event, pre-disaster is really the best opportunity to identify how to reduce your, you know, minimize your exposure, and how to train employees on what to do so that everyone knows how to respond correctly. Just to give you a few ideas and examples of chambers and how they came through during a crisis, I'll give you a couple. With San Diego during the 2007 wildfires, they really had quite a few different chambers in one county. And one of the things that really made a difference for them is it provided a focal point with one chamber saying, we've got the resources, we've got staff, we've got the facility, and since we were not directly impacted by the fires, we want to help facilitate communication sharing and help to facilitate information as well as different individuals and agencies that are coming into the community. So the San Diego Regional Chamber became a conduit. Again, they were not taking over for all the other chambers. They were just helping to lead the recovery effort. And so it really became a very appreciated role for them. It also made a difference as far as looking at the economic aspects and the long-term recovery impacts by using them as basically a contact, a direct contact, which can sometimes be very difficult when looking at a broad area of impact. Having one place to go to made it a lot easier instead of multiple chambers who were impacted getting many calls. So they really helped in streamlining a lot of the outside agencies and communication. With Iowa, specifically with the Cedar Rapids Chamber, they were directly impacted. While they didn't have floodwaters come into the chamber, they did have to evacuate. One of the real roles that they've taken on in this last month is looking out for small businesses, and specifically looking at those businesses that obviously have not made any money since the flooding started and are waiting on financial assistance, and they're trying to help find ways to bridge the gap for them to deal with paying employees, helping them make their bills, and so on and so forth. So they've really become an advocate for small business and are fighting a very good fight there because they had 400 city blocks that were flooded with 600 businesses impacted, and we're talking about 9,000 employees. So they've got a long road ahead of them as far as recovery, but they got right in and started working on developing recovery funds and a few others. Another that's very similar to that is the executive director of the Hancock County Chamber in the Mississippi Gulf that was impacted by Katrina. One of the things that they did post-Katrina was to create a 501c3 that could focus on economic and community development as they could accept donations and funds. And one of the things that was really helpful for them was to be visible to the community and be supportive, and because they will be and can be, as all of you can be in a disaster, the central point of information that brings businesses back into the community and helps them to work with government and so forth. I wanted to just talk real briefly about the application itself and just give you a couple things to think about. When looking at page 52 of the application, one of the things when looking at number 2 is the CPR, first aid, and the defibrillator usage. If you think about a disaster, it's when the normal responders are going to be overwhelmed dealing with a lot of other issues. And when it comes to addressing to the business community or the private sector, you may not see government and first responders for some time. So when looking at those, think of that as taking care of your employees and visitors. On number 3A, who's in charge of what task during an emergency, you can imagine that on a given day, your executive directors and presidents are not in the office. They could be attending meetings. They might be out of the area. And it's important to designate some backups and then also in the plan to identify the authority that those levels of backup or those positions have, what they can make decisions about. So, for instance, after an emergency, if you need to evacuate your facility, who has the authority to make that call? On letter B, you have method of communication to alert employees. And one way to look at that, and a very inexpensive way to look at that, is a phone tree at a very minimum. So you have one employee that calls 10, and then those employees call 10 others and so forth. It streamlines trying to reach many employees in a very short time frame. For larger organizations, I know they look at out-dialing systems and so forth, but again, when in your plan, keep it as simple as possible so it can actually be done when crisis strikes. For C, another way to look at how to contact one another is basically a very big issue when you have to evacuate a facility is accounting for your employees and staff, and just making sure that you think through how that's going to work if phones, especially cell phones, are down or you've lost power and you can't use other kinds of systems. On number 4, it says the crisis plan and communications guidelines. And think of the different individuals or different organizations you need to be in contact with, from your members, employees, stakeholders, responders, government groups, whoever that might be. So really break out how you want to communicate with each and what that will look like. From the next one on 5 is who is designated to address the media. And you definitely want to have a spokesperson who's going to be your point of contact and have that in your plan. You also want to make sure to set the policy whether or not it's okay for employees to talk to the media. So, for instance, if someone's only been there for 2 weeks, they should know whether or not they're allowed to speak to the media if they ask questions as they're coming into the office. And just make it clear who is the point of contact. The other thing, looking at 7, is does the crisis plan discuss the chamber's role? And I would say that that is a really critical one that we've seen about defining the role ahead of time, but also allowing some flexibility to tailor based on the events, the disaster events that unfold. So you really want to see where you want to step in, where your focus is based on your mission, based on what's most critical for your organization. And the last thing is about the backups, is how often you have backups, where are they, and how do you get to them? And I would say most of the organizations we've spoken to, they weren't doing backups frequently enough, so make sure you set the backups in your crisis plan to meet your objectives for your organization. And then make sure it's very clear how to get those backups, you know, back on site. So it's very important to just document everything, and that's where the plan will really help you in a crisis. So, Matthew, that's all I have.
right. Well, thank you, Inez. I think that was pretty informative, and I actually learned a lot. And I was wondering if you would be willing to take a few questions, if there are any.
Sure.
Are there any
questions? I guess my question is, how much should our crisis plan be integrated with the crisis plan for our city or county or community?
That's a very good question. I would say that there should be overlap between your plans, and a really important role is connecting with them, finding out what their plan says, and making sure that you don't have anything that's in conflict with that. Part of, and I've worked in the government side as well, part of it is that government doesn't always understand how the private sector works, and so part of the communication about the two plans is also sharing how things will work on your side as well, so they may have some inaccuracies in their plan that you can help them with. And then you're actually supporting public-private communications and coordination. So I would say that they don't have to be exactly the same because you have a different role. You know, for government, they're looking at critical life safety issues, but they do have to be supportive of one another.
Okay. I would say that my current plan, which has been in effect for about 6 years, is at three levels. It's our building has a problem, you know, has a fire, has whatever. How do we deal with that?
Mm-hmm.
The second one is, and so that's, you know, on a minimal level of, you know, we have some water in to the place burns down. But then the next level is really if there's a community-wide problem, how do we work with, for instance, our economic development agency and our downtown partnership to come together and work on economic development recovery?
Great. That's great.
I wouldn't say, and I guess the third level is that we're trying to think about if there was a really, truly major regional disaster, I don't know, you know, a terrorism, a giant something or other, where do we fit into regional disaster plans, which exist, and we've been in touch with our county about that, to say we are available to help. We don't know how we could be of help particularly at this point, but we would be there. Is that kind of what you're looking for?
Absolutely. In fact, when we've talked with different chambers through the help desk, a lot of chambers did not understand they had any role in a disaster. They felt that it was left up to local government, and that was government's role.
Yeah, well, I've worked in government, so that's not going to work.
Exactly. And
give that up.
Absolutely. And that's really an important part of it, is to find out what the role is. Now, here's the bottom line. There is no one looking after the interest of the business community as their number one priority. That's where the chambers have an opportunity to really step up and focus people's attention where it's needed with businesses. You can be the advocate. You can make sure that their voice is being heard as other decisions are being made. It can be a very, very important role in the recovery process.
Okay. Good. Thanks.
Thank you.
Hi, I'm calling from Orlando, and like when we had the three hurricanes in a row a number of summers ago, one of the things that we did was to make sure that all of our management team had car chargers for their cell phones, because we were out of power for so long that we wanted to make sure that they would be able to utilize the phone tree and those kinds of things. So that's a little hint that you may think about as well.
Very good point. Another piece is also, if it's a large enough event that you need to relocate your office or your facilities, having that as part of your plan. If that's a critical part of a role for you to be available, and as far as reopening the chamber, that's number six, reopening the chamber in the event of a catastrophic loss, if you have to relocate because your building is burned down or completely unavailable, how are you going to reconstitute somewhere else and make sure that you're going to be available to your members or for your mission?
Okay.
All right, this is Matthew again at the U.S. Chamber. Are there any final questions on the facilities section while we have Inez on the phone? All right, well, I'll move on to the new application, some of the questions with that. But I do want to thank Inez Pierce one more time for coming on and talking to us about crisis management.
Thanks, Matthew. I appreciate the opportunity.
Thank you, Inez.
Thank you.
So, yeah, the next part of our conference call today is just going to focus on the new application for 2008, just kind of an overview. We released the new application in January, so hopefully all of you have downloaded that new application, especially the folks that are due in a month. But we do feel that the new application had some significant changes that we did want to address them with you and kind of give you a first-person idea of how the new application works. Kind of the overall changes that were made were done to streamline it. We tried to get rid of the repetitive questions and kind of narrow the focus of the application to actually ask those hard-hitting questions on the actual process or on the actual substance of the application. We also separated the application into minimum requirements and additional criteria. This is kind of the number one question that I get, and that's the minimum requirements must be met in order to be accredited. So each of the nine sections of the application clearly shows which questions are the minimums that need to be answered and ultimately met in order to get accredited. The additional criteria follow those sections. The additional criteria are all the additional questions that we ask to determine your star ranking. So kind of the scoring on that is if you meet 70% to 80% of those minimum or those additional criteria, that's a 3-star. 4-star is about from 80 to 89% of the additional criteria are met. And then a 5-star is going to meet 90% or more. In addition to this scoring, the accreditation consultant can award up to 5 discretionary points throughout the application in any section. These points are awarded for exemplary programs and best practices. So really it's these points that kind of boost you up to the next level for doing the programs that you do that are innovative and community changing and just have a huge impact. But yeah, I kind of wanted to hear from first-hand view of the application. So is Myrna on the phone?
Yes, I am, Matthew.
Okay, I'll introduce Myrna. Myrna Ballard is the president and CEO of the Valdosta Lowndes County Chamber of Commerce in Valdosta, Georgia. She actually just recently got accredited with 5 stars and was the first chamber to obtain this designation using the new application. So I'll open it up to Myrna to give her point of view on it.
Hello, everyone from South Georgia. It's about 100 degrees down south, and we're enjoying wonderful weather. Actually, it's a little bit dry. We could use some more rain. There's a pretty bad echo, Matthew, so I'm kind of hearing myself, and it's a little bit distracting. If there's anything you can do, that's already better. Thank you. I want to share with everyone that we actually started our process 1 year before our package was due in March of 2008. We took this very, very seriously. In fact, we wanted to go after our reaccreditation 1 year early, because we just were confident that we had a 5-star chamber and we were sitting at 4 stars before, and we just didn't want to wait another year to make certain that we were on track to become a 5-star chamber. We're a community of about 100,000. We have 1,559 members as of today and a staff of 14. We are a standalone chamber, which I find to be very, very helpful in keeping us focused on those things that chambers, in my view, need to be doing. We started the process more than a year ago with a handful of really, really dedicated volunteers who served on the reaccreditation task force, and I do mean a handful. We didn't involve casts of thousands. We had about a dozen people with specific responsibilities for each of the sections. We started our process by identifying the 5-star chambers in the country that were about our size, and our volunteers divided that list up, and we had a questionnaire that we developed that we each used to survey, I think it was a total of 10 five-star chambers. And we wanted to find out what we thought was, what they felt had been their secrets to success. And I want to recommend that all of you do this if you have not done it. Talk to some five-star chambers, visit some five-star chambers, which we also did. Find out what they felt their secrets of success were. Also, if you think there are if you have in mind that there are some myths or some reasons that you think you cannot get a five-star rating, ask those questions, whatever it is you think might be your obstacle. For us, we had heard the rumor that the U.S. Chamber was not going to award five stars to any chamber that did not endorse candidates and have a PAC and did not recruit people to run for public office. And we just simply didn't find that to be the case when we talked to the other five-star chambers. We found about, I think, a third did and two-thirds did not. So don't let yourself get bogged down with any myths. Try to go to the source and find out what the real story is. Before I leave that, let me share this little tip with you, though, on the government affairs section. If you are like our chamber and you do not endorse candidates and you do not have a PAC, I think it's very helpful to tell the U.S. Chamber why. We didn't want to just check no on anything without explaining why the answer was no. We did explain to the U.S. Chamber that we thoughtfully consider this issue on a regular basis, I'd say every couple of years, because we want to keep testing the water to see if anything has changed. So I would suggest that if you do have to check no to that answer about endorsing candidates and having a PAC, explain why that is the case and how it works in your community. So back to the process. It took us a year to do this to do this well, and I would recommend that if you, for any reason, feel that your package is going to be rushed or not the very best that it can be, I would recommend that you take another 3 months or whatever the next deadline is to spend the time you need to spend to make certain that you tell your story in the best way possible. I'm sure you're all five-star chambers, but you have to be able to share that with the U.S. Chamber. And if you're in a rush and kind of trying to cram everything into those last few weeks, you're not going to have that reflective time that you need to sit down and look at your package and think to yourself, oh, you know, we need to add this. Or when I checked yes to this question, I really wish I had elaborated on something that's very, very special and unique that our chamber does, because I promise you, if you have time to do that, it will pay off, and the U.S. Chamber does want to know about those very exemplary programs that Matthew talked about. You want those five discretionary points that come to you if you do a good job of explaining and describing the very community-changing programs that your chamber is doing. Again, I mentioned that we submitted early. We actually had another year to go, but we wanted very much to get those five stars next to our name. We also had the option of using either the old form or the brand new form, and it was actually a lot of extra work for us to do the 2000 use the new format, because we had already put a great deal of work into the old form. But we took a look at that 2008, the new and improved, and I do mean that seriously, the new format, and we chose to go with the new format because we felt it was more rigorous. And why go through this huge effort if it isn't going to really mean something? And we wanted to be able to say that we had tested and challenged ourselves to the utmost. So we went with the new format, which I think is more of a rifle approach than the old format, which was a little bit of a shotgun. And to be honest, I think there was a little bit of room with the essay questions in the old form, you could go on and on, I guess, about some areas that may or may not have been that important. With the new form, it really keeps you focused and rifled in on those things that make a great chamber a great chamber. So I'm very, very glad we did go to the extra effort and the extra trouble to dump the work that we'd done on the original format and go with the new format. Let's see, I've covered the things that we did as far as government affairs were concerned. I also want to mention something else under government affairs that Matthew asked me to mention. We are recognized by our state chamber as being one of the, if not the best, I always think we're the best, government affairs program of any local chamber in Georgia. And the president of the Georgia Chamber wrote a letter of recommendation to the U.S. Chamber on our behalf. We also had letters from our congressmen and from our state delegation talking about the efforts and the initiative that the Valdosta-Lowndes County Chamber takes on state and federal level issues. And one of the things that I wish I had done, and I will remember to do it next time, is to ask our regional chamber person, her name is Debbie Carruthers, to ask Debbie to just maybe write a letter. I hope this wouldn't be a conflict of interest in any way, Matthew, but to write a letter just stating in factual terms what she knows about the things that we have done to make certain our members and our community are aware of what the U.S. Chamber is doing and what's going on the federal level. That, I think that's a good tip for you as well. Another tip, there are so many opportunities for you to simply check yes and move along, and you're going to be tempted to do that as you get toward the end of the process. But when you check yes on one of the items, and you have something in the back of your mind that says, you know, I really would like to tell the U.S. Chamber about exactly what we do in this area, I would encourage you to at least write a sentence or two about that. Don't miss those opportunities to get above and beyond the minimum requirements for accreditation or for reaccreditation. And again, if you must check no to anything, add a sentence or two as to why you had to answer no to that particular question, because sometimes it can make all the difference. Matthew also asked me to talk to you a little bit about our post-accreditation announcement. We did receive notification from Matthew back in June that we had the five-star reaccreditation, but we only officially announced it to our community last week. And we did make a big deal of it, and our community is making a big deal of it. The thing that I keep stressing, in fact, I did a television interview this morning, the thing that we keep stressing is this is all about our members. It is all about building the kind of chamber that our members deserve and that this fantastic community deserves. It's not about what I did, what my staff did. It's not even about what our volunteers have done. It's about the U.S. Chamber acknowledging that we're providing a true value to our members and we're making a difference, a true difference in our community. And I promise you, that's what I'm in it for. I don't have anything else on my notes, Matthew, but I would certainly be happy to answer any questions that anyone has.
Yeah, that was the next thing on the agenda. So, yeah, please, I'll open it up to question and answer.
Well, this is Katrina from Mobile. You suggested that if there are answers that we have to say no to, that we give an explanation.
Yes.
And I agree with that. I think that's a great idea. In the first section, though, for instance, it says, is there a documented written process in place to evaluate the performance of officers and directors? Well, who does have that? Do you have that sort of thing?
Yes, we actually do. But, you know, if I had to answer no to that question, I think I would probably want to share with the U.S. Chamber what we do. You know, we might not have a written process.
Mm-hmm.
However, Each year, the nominating committee discusses the various contributions of each particular member. I mean, you know, that's
right.
You can explain to them what you do, because that's what they really want to know. I mean, they might prefer that you have something more formalized, but it's much better to let them know that you acknowledge the importance of that activity rather than just say no and leave the impression that you don't think that's an important thing for a chamber to do.
Mm-hmm.
Does that make sense?
Well, it does. To that, it also asks, do you do background checks on prospective board members? Do you check references? I can see where you can say what you do instead of that.
Well, we do our best not to have any criminals on our board, but we don't do criminal background checks,
right.
But we most definitely, we make them earn their seat on the board. Well, I think the way we answered that one, Katrina, if I'm remembering correctly, is that we have a written policy that says that chamber board members must be, I've forgotten the wording we use, but the number one person in their organization, either the owner or the very top person in the community in that business. They must be business people, and they must have proven themselves by serving on a committee, chairing a committee, et cetera. So that's the kind of background check we do.
Right. Okay. Thank you.
You're welcome.
This is Janice Shepherd in Dothan, Alabama. I noticed that some of you have a committee to put your reaccreditation or accreditation process together, and some do it in-house. Is there any bearing on the accreditation stars, whether it's done by a committee or if it's actually done in-house by staff?
Matthew, I'll ask you to answer that one.
There is actually no bearing on the scoring, whether you do it in-house as staff-driven or with a committee or with the board. It was a requirement, I think, over 5 years ago that it be volunteer-driven, but the industry has kind of been changing and things are being done in-house with the staff. So we left it open to do it either way. And I can't say that one way is better than the other, and we don't score one way or the other.
Okay, thank you.
If I might add to that, we used, as I mentioned, about a dozen highly committed and very appropriate volunteers for each of the particular areas, the sections. And I would not trade the input and the assistance and the perspective of those volunteers for anything. You know, I have plenty of chamber staff who can put the information together, but what they can't do is lend that perspective from the outside, from the volunteer perspective. They reminded us of things that we do and have done that, you know, our staff had even was taking for granted. So I'm one of those, I guess, rare people who really feels that five heads are better than four and four heads are better than three. And when you put people around the table who know your chamber inside and out, they can help you. Plus, it helps generate that buzz in the chamber and in the community about the accreditation process. And I have board members who are as proud as I am that we've gained this five-star recognition. So that's good for your chamber.
Myrna, I agree. This is Melody from LaGrange, Georgia.
Hello, Melody.
How are you?
Great.
The other good thing about the volunteers being involved is they learn things about the chamber that they don't know by just sitting on the board or even working on a committee. When they go through the accreditation process, they start to learn what the chamber is really about. And the more people in the community that can actually know that, the better off your chamber is.
Amen.
This is Diana Seberg. Hello?
Hello, Diana.
Yeah, I'm with the Somerset County Business Partnership. We are an accredited chamber of commerce. We're going for our 25th year of continuous accreditation. However, during the past several years, we've gone through some different gyrations within our organization. And not only do we have a C6, but we also have a C3. So my question has to do with whether we are able to include the activities of the C3 within the accreditation, economic development, shared services, tourism.
I think Matthew can answer that from a U.S. Chamber perspective. I can tell you that we did include our 501c3's activities. It's our Workforce Development Board, and that is definitely an important part of our Chamber's activities. Matthew, is there anything you need to add to that?
No, I just want to – the application is written from a Chamber's point of view and written for a Chamber that doesn't have you know, it has some with economic development, but not much. We, of course, welcome any input you can provide in talking about your 501c3 arm of that, whether it be workforce development or, you know, additional education, leadership programs, or and just kind of feel that you need to find a place in the application where that is relevant and work it in. But, yeah, we're more than happy to see it.
Great. Okay, thank you.
Matthew, this is Wendy Bailey in Toccoa, Georgia, Toccoa Stevens County.
Hello, Wendy.
Hi.
Hi, Wendy.
Hey, we're accredited currently, and I'm new to the chamber, though, and so this will be my first time going through the process. I'm looking at the 2008 application, and I was looking for those 5 discretionary points. I can't find them. Where are they located?
They can be given out by the consultant anywhere in the application. So I don't believe they're in the instructions on this application. We do want to work them in and let chambers know that we are actually awarding 5 additional points. But they can come up anywhere. They can come up in, like I said, exemplary programs or policies that you already have, meaning that we could give an extra point to your legislative agenda or your board or orientation program. Or they can come up for programs that we've never seen before. Maybe in one of the essays you mentioned a wellness program that you're running with member companies. And we just find that to be something new and innovative in trying to get around the problems with insurance. And so that's kind of where we're awarding those points. They can come up anywhere in the application that our consultant finds your chamber to just be leading the field.
And, you know, Matthew, there's a new section in the new format called benchmarking, and that is such an outstanding area to – it's such a great way to tell your chamber's story that perhaps you weren't asked about in other sections or at all in the old format. And I've always felt that that might be a great opportunity for those discretionary points to be able to highlight some of your special programs in the benchmarking section.
Okay, I understand now. Thank you.
Oh, you're welcome.
And if I could, just one more. Is there a limit to the number of words for the essay questions?
I think we like to limit it to about 3 pages of single space. So while you won't be punished for going over, we do like to see essays around the 2-2.5 page limit. But on that, those essays should include numerous examples of programs that you do and definitely have quantitative data in them showing kind of how the programs or that whatever you're talking about is advancing and working.
And then do we call you, Matthew, if we have if we wanted to identify chambers our size who have received the 5-star accreditation, or is that listed on the website?
It is on our website. We have a map that you can kind of click and look at your state, the accredited chambers there. We also have an Excel document that's available on the website to download where you can look at the 5 stars, and then you just kind of have to gauge it by the name of the chamber. We don't have any stats on there on members or size.
If you have a copy of the World Chamber Directory, that will help you with the population and membership size.
Yes, thank you.
Matthew?
Yes.
This is Bonnie Frogner in Griffin, Georgia. I think you got a lot of Georgia folks today.
Hi, Bonnie.
Hi. you give some examples of different policies and procedures in case your chamber does not currently have one in relation to the different subjects that we're covering. Do you recommend or do you have further websites that you can recommend that we could visit and perhaps look at to draw in a little bit more information and criteria as we develop our own policies and procedures in the different areas, like the crisis plan and things?
Well, I try and continuously update our website, which has the best practices. I know there's probably 60 different documents on there now.
Okay.
As for additional websites, I can probably only think of the basic ones that you've probably looked at yourself first. This, statistics at ACCE. I know the Ohio Chamber executives are creating a interactive kind of posting of those types of policies. I don't know if it's going to be member only, but they're working on it. And I think other state organizations, chamber associations are looking into that as well.
Okay.
But I try to keep our documents fresh, and as the new application, Myrna said, was more of that rifle shot. As it gets more specific, I'll definitely have some great resources to put on there as, applications come in and people keep getting better.
Okay, thank you.
Bonnie, that the best practices section on the U.S. Chamber's accreditation page was absolutely invaluable to us.
Okay, were you able to use those in total, or did you just go back and take the general ideas, adapt them, and rewrite, or, you be a little bit?
All of the above. What we found to be most helpful was just to be able to compare our documents with what others were doing, and it allowed us a lot of times to be able to improve on things that the documents that we already were using. And in other cases, there were things that we needed to really completely revamp, and it gave us some good ideas there.
Okay, thanks.
Great.
See, do we have any more questions?
Matthew.
Yes.
This is Shirley Bardis in Beaumont, Texas. On page 15 of the application, it talks about affiliates. And this is where we put our 501c3 information. Is this an okay place to put that?
Yes, it is. I think this is where we do want to see the 501c3s in the overall governance of that organization within yours.
All right. Thank you.
All right. As we approach an hour here, are there any last-minute questions?
Matthew, it's Patty from the Midland Chamber in Michigan.
Yes.
We're scheduled to go to the new format in 09, and I'm wondering if you can touch on how we include samples that are supposed to be included in the application.
Okay. I did not mention that in my little spiel there. For 2009, we do have an online, or it's a digital platform that we're going to be using. So in 2009, we will no longer be taking paper applications, so you'll no longer have to work with a binder and printing things off. Instead, what they're going to be are some pretty state-of-the-art PDF documents that will be available for download on our website. And then you continuously work on those documents after you've saved them on your own computer. Those documents will look just like our application now. No questions have changed. So the 2008 application that you can download now will be the one that we use in 2009. But the application will allow you to just fill out the questions as is, and then with about two or three clicks of the mouse, you can actually embed your current documents, whether they be a Word document, an Excel document, a PDF, maybe a movie clip now, or some sort of multimedia PowerPoint. You just two or three clicks, and it will actually embed itself into the document. It will save as one document, and then when the consultant opens it up or you open it up the next time, you just need to click on the icon, and it will bring up that document. So that's how we hope to embed the attachments that you're working on now directly into the application. And then the PDF document will also have a sticky note function, which will allow you to comment on each yes or no answer. Kind of like we discussed, where if you do have a no and want to justify why, again, it's just a simple right click, and you can insert your own little sticky note, they're called, as to why you're doing what you're doing or how you're doing it. And that should be released in October, we're hoping. We're doing extensive pilot testing now with some accredited chambers that volunteered to help us, and by 2009, we will be online and ready to go. So my recommendation is just to kind of continue to work on the application as you're doing now, saving things either online or on your network in a file, just so you can easily pretty much drag it over to the PDF file when it's available in October and embed it. Does that answer your question?
It does, with the exception of like samples of a magazine that we would like to include if we're talking about something specific, and we don't have that in a in an electronic format. What would you recommend?
We do recommend that you still can send that in to us. We will review things in-house, so it will get to the consultant's eyes. If you have it online as a an archive on your website, we can just do links to that. But if you truly do want to send in the hard copy of something, we will still take that, and that could just be a simple, manila envelope that you send in and instead of the huge binder.
Okay, gotcha.
Matthew?
Yes.
This is Paula White with the Burney Chamber of Commerce. We just did our letter of intent in for the August 31st deadline. We have been working on ours for a year or a little over a year, and didn't know when we started working on it. It was the 2007 application, and when I visited with you a couple months ago in Washington, you told me about the 2008. So we're trying to transfer everything over. Can we extend that deadline now that we know that? And since we started on it 2007, do we still have to go with the 2008? Application.
We do want to see all new applications in from now on. We had our grandfather clause into March, but yeah, maybe we'll talk about it later.
Okay.
But yeah, if you do need to extend and we realize that you want to do the new 2008 application, we'd be happy to extend your deadline.
Okay, thank you.
Anyone else?
Is Myrna there?
Yes.
This is Jim Cougar in Minneapolis. I just have a question that just is really going to sound weird. Do you know Jim Shadrack, or Hank Lee?
I know Hank Lee.
You know Hank?
I do.
You do?
Yes, he's with Lee Office Supplies.
Yeah, he was. He's a member of the Elks Club down there.
Yeah. And may I have your name again, please, Jim?
Jim Cougar.
Cougar. I will tell Hank I spoke with you.
Tell Hank, and then I know Diane. If you know Diane, you know Diane?
I don't.
That was his wife. That was his ex-wife.
Oh, no, I don't. I'm sorry.
We go back a long. Jimmy Shadrack had an insurance agency down there for years.
Everybody knows somebody in Valdosta.
Yeah, I know. I lived down there for 5 years.
Oh, I see. Well, it's nice talking with you.
Nice talking to you.
Matthew?
Yes.
This is Bonnie again in Griffin, and I just want to thank you for this opportunity of allowing us to call in and have this conversation and glean some more information as we prepare our applications.
Oh, I'm happy to do this. I think it's a great exercise, and I only hope that the quality of the calls are continually getting better and they are pertinent to what you're working on.
Bonnie, this is Myrna.
Yes.
Don't you think we should try to get Matthew to come down to our GACCE staff clinic in March and do a little workshop for us on accreditation?
I think absolutely. That would be great. I think all the people in Georgia would appreciate it.
Absolutely.
I'd be happy to attend. All right. Well, we are approaching the hour mark, and I know everyone's busy, so if there's a few last-minute calls, I'll stay on the line. But anyone else that needs to get to an important meeting or something else is free to go, and I appreciate your time this afternoon.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Matthew.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Matthew, you're still on the line?
Yes, I am.
Okay. Good afternoon, Chamber of Commerce. May I help you?
Cheryl has a question here.
Okay.
Matthew, on page 17, question 2, the second box, procedures for application of chamber revenues.
Okay. Let's see, so it's 17, number 2. Okay.
We appreciate your patience. Please be assured that your
call
will
receive
the
time
and attention.
Are you still there? I'm here. Are you there?
Yes, I don't know what's going on.
I don't either.
I guess it's probably Quest trying to come in. So it says just indicate which clauses are addressed in your financial policies and procedures manual.
No, it says procedures for application of chamber revenues.
Oh.
Thank you for your patience. You will be assisted momentarily. Please stay on the
line. I am not the finance guy. I usually go to my CPAs on this one. I'm not quite sure what that one means either. I'll have to ask the writers of this section.
Okay.
I imagine it's just reporting structures for revenue.
Okay.
I mean, other than the procedures, I know what's going into those financial policies. It's just the procedures to handle money and to report money. But as for that exact clause and that wording, it does sound a little odd. I will ask a CPA what they mean there. But I think I've got 5 or 6 financial policies on the website now.
I'll go look at it.
And they're great. I mean, all of them. And then I've seen a lot of the same ones kind of show up lately, but we like that. So,
okay.
If a chamber's doing it right, then there's nothing wrong with a little cutting and pasting.
Great. Okay, I appreciate you.
Oh, no problem. Thank you for attending. Mm-hmm. Is anyone else on the line?
Hey, Matthew, it's Ruth in Orlando.
Oh, hi, Ruth.
I just didn't know. I had sent you an email. We were out on vacation and stuff, and I had sent. Did you get all your test case people lined up for the electronic application?
No, I'm still looking for volunteers.
Because we would probably be interested in testing that out. I mean, we're working toward a December submission anyway.
Okay.
So I think we will proceed, if you want us to with the paper application. And then I think the last time I had heard it wouldn't be coming out until November, but if it's coming out earlier in October, that might be a timeline where we could just be able to transfer everything to the electronic format. So if you want to add us to that list, that would be great.
All right, I'd be happy to.
Okay.
Because, we're close. The pilot testing is going really well, and chambers are really liking this new format. And it's not online, so you don't really have to worry about, having the servers up and updating. It can easily be just downloaded from our site and transferred to working at home you need to for a couple of days just to transfer things over.
Mm-hmm.
We're happy about it, and I definitely think it's going to be a lot easier.
Yeah, sounds good. I've done some grant applications, like with Bank of America, and they
that
all online. So I imagine it's going to be similar to that, right?
It is. Actually,
where you go to a section and you can type in the stuff, and then you can upload the financials or you can upload the sample brochures or whatever. So I would imagine it would be pretty similar to that.
It is. I've heard it's very similar to bank applications and then almost identical to I don't know if you're dealing with them, but we sure are here, the lobby reports that have to be submitted to the IRS.
Oh.
So.
You know, I heard somebody talking about that, and they said it was great, except it was never, you could never get on and stuff like that. And it was, you know, filing tax monies and all that kind of stuff, collections of tax, state taxes and stuff. And they were so frustrated by the system. I mean, they love the opportunity to be able to do it that way.
Right.
But then, you know, the system would be down or, you know, something wouldn't transfer or whatever. But,
right.
Just wanted to mention that to you, and if you want to put me on the list and then communicate whatever you have to communicate on that, we'd love to give that a try as well.
That sounds great.
Okay.
Okay.
All right. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Ruth.
Bye-bye.
Bye.